In March 1940, the New English Weekly published a review by George Orwell of Mein Kampf. Mein Kampf is, of course, the part autobiography, part manifesto, written by Adolf Hitler. And in his fascinating review, then, Orwell probes what made Hitler so attractive to people, how he won the hearts and minds of men and women so that they wanted him as their leader. And this is Orwell's explanation. He writes, "Nearly all Western thought since the last war has assumed tacitly that human beings desire nothing beyond ease, security, and avoidance of pain. Hitler knows that human beings don't only want comfort, safety, short working hours, hygiene, and common sense. They also, at least intermittently, want struggle and self-sacrifice, not to mention drums, flags, and loyalty parades. However they may be as economic theories, fascism and Nazism are psychologically far sounder than any hedonistic conception of life. Whereas socialism and capitalism have said to people, 'I offer you a good time,' Hitler has said to them, 'I offer you struggle, danger, and death.' And as a result, a whole nation flings itself at his feet." Now, Orwell's, and if he's right, Hitler's assessment of the human psyche is, of course, a generalization. There are people who genuinely do want a quiet, sedate life from the cradle to the grave. But to a significant degree, they're probably right that many of us don't want that. Not all the time. We get weary of the steady and the stable and the routine. We want to be involved in something radical, some kind of cause that's uncompromising and necessitates the disruption of ordinary everyday life. That appeals to us somehow. And some, over the last 2,000 years, have embraced Christianity as that kind of thing, as a subversive, destabilizing, restless, mover and shaker kind of movement. Having become Christians, they have deemed their new faith this radical thing that requires the whole fabric of normal life to be ripped up. It has taken different forms. So some Christians have withdrawn from society. They have formed Christian communes, living together, renouncing private ownership of possessions, experiencing minimal contact with the outside world. Then again, some Christians have embraced a certain very fixed model of gender roles, whereby women must wear skirts and refrain from paid employment, and men must sport very manly facial hair. Then again, some Christians have concocted plans for taking over the various state apparatus and turning Britain or the US or wherever into a Christian nation. And so we could go on with many examples. And in Corinth, in the middle of the first century, there were Christians with this kind of outlook, with a highly dramatic conception of discipleship. To them, becoming a Christian disciple inevitably pulled down the pillars and tore apart the basic contours of your life. Everything had to change. Everything had to be reset. In virtually no areas could your daily existence retain its pre-conversion shape, because this thing is radical after all. Following Christ is radical. And we saw last time then that marriages in the Corinthian church were being affected by this type of thinking. They were falling victim to this approach to discipleship. "We can't carry on in our marriages," some were saying. "Not now that we are Christians. We're living on a different plane now. A higher, nobler plane. We can't be held back by the banalities of a marital relationship." And especially we saw those married to an unbeliever were saying such things. "My conversion to Christ demands far-reaching structural change. I can't continue sharing my bed and sharing my life with this hell-bound reprobate as though nothing has happened, as though becoming a Christian were a small, trifling thing. It's not at all a small, trifling thing. It upsets the apple cart. It overturns the status quo. It shakes the foundations, becoming a Christian does. And that must begin then in this grotesquely mismatched marriage of mine. Now, on this specific matter of conversion ripping up marriages, Paul has already made his views clear. No, in a word. No. Conversion does not and should not rip up marriages. We looked at that 2 weeks ago. But now in this evening's passage, he deals with the notion that conversion rips up our pre-conversion circumstances more broadly. The notion that becoming a Christian is this radical renunciation of your former life situation. And again, we can sum up his message in that one word, no. No. Nazism may have offered a seductive diversion from humdrum normality. It may have said, exchange the familiar rhythms of your everyday lives for something different and exciting, for drums, flags, and loyalty parades. Christianity, Paul will now spell out, says nothing of the sort. I have three headings. And first of all, then, the meaning. The meaning. Let's make sure that we're clear on what everything means here. And the first thing to establish is that throughout this passage, calling has its usual New Testament meaning. That is to say, it means conversion. A classic calling text comes earlier on in this letter, chapter 1, verse 9. God is faithful, by whom you were called into the fellowship of his Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord. That's the kind of call that the New Testament is always interested in. And that's the calling, then, that this passage, too, is interested in. That calling at conversion into fellowship with God's Son, Jesus Christ. And that's the calling, then, that Paul is talking about in the opening verse of our passage, there in verse 17. Now, it shouldn't be translated, that verse, only let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him and to which God has called him. That sounds like a different sort of calling is in view here. A calling to a particular set of circumstances, rather than a calling to Jesus Christ at conversion. But the translation there is unhelpful in the Greek text. It's only let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him as God has called him. As God has called him. So Paul is talking then about the moment of God's call into the fellowship of his Son. The moment of conversion. And he's saying, as your circumstances in life were then, at that moment, when called into fellowship with Christ, let them still be. As your circumstances were then when you were called, let them still be. Now, at this point, I need to clarify my comments in my introduction a couple of minutes ago. I may have given the impression that radical is a bad word in connection with Christianity. There have been these different people throughout the last 2,000 years who thought Christianity is radical, and they were wrong. Because in actual fact, Christian discipleship is utterly colourless and a mind-numbing business. I may have given you that impression. That's not the case. No, becoming a Christian is radical. It's to be called by God, Paul is saying here and in so many other places in the New Testament. And this call of God, then, it isn't like any call that you and I are familiar with. When we call a child in from the garden because it's dinner time, or when we call a member of staff at the supermarket to come over and sort out the self-service till because it's just jammed for the 14th time, that call is a merely verbal phenomenon, isn't it? God's call that we're talking about here, it's more than verbal. It's a force. God's call is a force, not just something verbal. It's an almighty, irresistible force that powerfully propels you out of Adam into Christ, out of darkness into light, out of death into life, out of Satan's tyranny into God's kingdom, out of the flesh into the spirit, out of Babylon into the New Jerusalem, out of the broad way that leads to destruction into the narrow way that leads to life. So please don't think that I'm downplaying and minimizing Christian conversion. It's an invincible divine summons, is Christian conversion. It's an explosive, omnipotent propulsion. But this is the thing. While the propulsion, that propelling, experienced in conversion is indeed explosive and omnipotent, it isn't total. It isn't total. It propels you out of your lost and hopeless and hell-bound condition, but it doesn't propel you out of your marriage, or out of your singleness, or out of your job, or out of your place of residence, or out of your ethnic identity, or out of your social class. It doesn't propel you out of your life situation. Those movers and shakers throughout church history, whether the monastics or the skirt wearers or the promoters of the Christian state, or indeed the marriage forsakers there in Corinth, they were right about Christianity being radical because it is radical, but they were wrong on how it's radical. Suppose, you see, someone hundreds of years ago could have been told that one day human beings would be able to climb inside a huge metal tube and be propelled through the sky at 500 miles per hour. How would that person hundreds of years ago have imagined that experience? How would that person have imagined air travel? Probably as something terrifying and painful, something that would leave you hurt and traumatized. That person hundreds of years ago couldn't have conceived of people being propelled through the sky at 500 miles per hour while at the same time sitting in comfy seats and drinking coffee and carrying on normal activities. And you see, the Corinthians couldn't conceive of people being propelled out of their lostness into salvation by the mighty call of God while at the same time being husbands and wives and maintaining marriages and maintaining homes and carrying on normal activities. But Paul is saying that's how it works. That's how it works. Just as the person on the transatlantic flight is being powerfully transplanted from one continent to another, while at the same time sitting there knitting or playing Sudoku or whatever, it's this combination of the extraordinary and the ordinary. The person becoming a Christian experiences an infinitely greater transplantation than that, yet keeps on living at number 43 and putting the bins out once a week and doing the daily commute to work and all the rest of it. That's just how it works, Paul is saying. In some ways, everything changes at conversion. You're now a new creature, but in some ways, nothing changes. Your life situation continues in all its unspectacular familiarity. Now, in terms of that continuing life situation, then, Paul, of course, mainly has in mind marriage here. That's what he's been talking about in the preceding verses. Your marriage carries on after conversion. That's his main point, I think, because it's there particularly that the Corinthians are trying to shake things up. But he here in these verses has two additional examples, doesn't he? And both are really rather remote to us. One is your status vis-a-vis circumcision when you're converted. The other is your status vis-a-vis slavery when you're converted. And as I say, then both of those examples are rather remote to us. But you can see, can't you, how they relate to Paul's arguments. In the first century, circumcision and slavery were very live issues indeed. It was a key component of your life situation that you were either circumcised or uncircumcised. You were either slave or free. And Paul is saying then, your conversion doesn't demand change in those areas. Your conversion propels you out of the grave of your unregenerate existence. But it doesn't propel you out of your circumcision. It doesn't propel you out of your daily life as some wealthy Corinthian slave. Those things are unaffected by your conversion. Verse 19 is crucial. It's blunter and more emphatic in the Greek than we have it here in our English version. Paul literally says there, circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing. That repeated word nothing really hits you in the Greek text. And Paul means then circumcision and uncircumcision are totally irrelevant to your having become Christians. If you were a visitor here and you told me in the foyer afterwards, "I'm a postman." And I responded, well, what does that mean then in terms of the kind of music you can listen to? You go, "You what?" Or if you said, "I'm a teacher." And I replied, "So what does that mean in terms of the kind of car you can drive?" You go, "Eh?" If you're a postman, then posting letters is what matters. What kind of music you listen to isn't relevant. It's nothing. If you're a teacher, then teaching children is what matters. What kind of car you drive isn't relevant. It's nothing. And if you're a Christian, Paul says in this verse 19, keeping the commandments of God is what matters. Your life situation isn't relevant. It's nothing. Again, we're back to that distinction between the right kind of radical and the wrong kind of radical. Christians are radical in the sense of practicing radical obedience to God's commandments as they're found here in this book, the Bible. They are radical by virtue of doing that, not by virtue of recklessly ditching their marriages and their jobs and their homes and the basic structures of their everyday lives. So I hope you get the essential meaning of this passage then. Conversion, though supernatural, profoundly supernatural, conversion doesn't rip to shreds all the circumstances and details of your life. They continue. You carry on in the same life situation that you had before conversion. Because it's not your circumstances that matter. It's your obedience. Your obedience to the commands of God that matters. The meaning. Notice with me, secondly this evening, the misapplications. The misapplications. Because what we've just been saying could be misapplied then. It could be misapplied in at least two ways. So misapplication number one, this means my life situation is of no interest to God. My life situation is of no interest to God. Isn't that an implication of all that we've just been saying? Well, no, it's not. You see, we need to be clear on this business that keeping the commandments of God is what matters. Paul isn't saying that your job and your domestic situation are trivial and inconsequential, a chunk of your life that God doesn't really care tuppence about. Because it's only when you leave your job behind and you leave your domestic situation behind and you go and keep his commandments by having a quiet time or attending the prayer meeting or doing some evangelism, it's only then that God suddenly becomes interested. Paul isn't saying that. Because you see, this keeping the commandments of God that he's talking about, it takes place largely within your job and within your domestic situation. It's you being a fair and upright employer. It's you being a conscientious and submissive employee. It's you being a holy and helpful single person. It's you being a loving and loyal married person. That's the kind of keeping the commandments of God that Paul is talking about here, which means then that God is profoundly interested in our life situations. They are the spheres in which he looks for our obedience. Look at verse 24, the end of the passage there, where Paul sums up, "So brothers, in whatever condition each was called, there let him remain." We've dealt with that. We know what Paul means by that. But then those last two words, "with God." There, in those circumstances, that job, that marriage, that domestic setup, there let him remain with God. With God. He means that in your everyday circumstances, in those circumstances, you are to use that great Latin phrase, coram Deo, before the face of God. He's there. He sees. He's interested. Not just when you're doing something spiritual, something Christian, something sacred, but in your ordinary circumstances. He's there. You're with him. He's seeing. He's attentive. He's noting things. He's interested. Let me be as precise as I can here. The point in this passage is not that your life situation doesn't matter. The point is that which kind of life situation yours is doesn't really matter. Whatever your life situation looks like, whatever it happened to be when you were converted, God will be there within it. Within that life situation, you don't need to relocate to a different life situation, a different set of circumstances, of a kind that God can inhabit. No, God will be there in yours, whatever that is, whatever it looks like. He will be there deriving pleasure from your keeping his commandments there. You might be a slave in Corinth, doing utterly, utterly menial stuff every day and every night, without any breaks and any holidays. But God is there in that life situation and deriving pleasure from your obedience there. So that's misapplication number one. And then misapplication number two, this means I must never deliberately change my life situation. Isn't that what Paul's saying? Remain. Remain as you were when you were converted. Remain in precisely that situation. So this means, presumably, I must never deliberately change my life situation. Well, again, that distorts Paul's point. Certainly, if you're a married person at conversion, Paul has been very clear, you must not deliberately change that. Paul has been adamant on that in those earlier verses that we considered previously. But he isn't saying here that if you're single when you're converted, then you're permanently locked into that. Or that you must stay in the same job and in the same place throughout your entire Christian life. Indeed, Paul adds that parenthesis, doesn't he, in verse 21 to slaves there at the end of that verse. If you can gain your freedom, avail yourself of the opportunity. So Paul isn't prohibiting Christians changing their circumstances. He's simply saying you don't need to change your circumstances because you're a Christian. Your conversion to Christ doesn't require it in the name of being radical. It won't make you a more authentic disciple to change everything. It won't make the angels in heaven nudge each other and say, look at that guy giving up his job and reinventing his entire life situation. He's really sold out for Jesus. No, such change isn't necessary, Paul is saying. But it is legitimate. It is okay. It is permitted. It's just not necessary in order to honour and glorify our God. So those are then a couple of possible misapplications. But let's hasten on to one last thing here. We've seen the meaning and we've seen the misapplications. But then thirdly and finally, the mindset. The mindset. Because Paul then, in this passage, is encouraging a certain mindset for Christians generally, whether it's in first century Corinth, whether it's in 21st century Newcastle. Paul is encouraging here a certain mindset, and I'm going to sum it up in three words. And first of all, then, liberty. Liberty. Do you remember back in chapter 6, verse 12, that slogan, "All things are lawful for me"? And we said, didn't we, that Paul is there quoting the Corinthian slogan. It's them that are continually saying this, all things are lawful, all things are lawful. And they're even saying it as a pretext for sleeping with prostitutes, remarkably enough. But we also said, didn't we, that they'd kind of gotten it to some degree from Paul himself. Because really, that was Paul's outlook. That was Paul's default position. His default position was not everything's dubious until proven legitimate, but rather we said Paul's default position was everything's legitimate until proven from Scripture to be dubious. That was Paul's way of looking at the world. And this concept then, all things are lawful, it applies then to our life situations that we've been talking about this evening. All are lawful. Yes, of course, a few are not. So if your domestic situation is cohabiting with a partner to whom you're not married, if your domestic situation is a same-sex marriage, if your job is as a sex worker or as a mafia boss or something, then of course those aspects of your life situation do need to be ripped up when you're converted to Jesus Christ. Of course that's true. The call to Christ in that case must propel you out of your life situation, because the very essence of that life situation involves violating the commandments of God. But generally speaking, yes, there are exceptions, but generally speaking, all life situations are lawful, Paul is saying here. The Christian is at liberty when it comes to what to study, what job to do, where to live. Verse 23 of our passage, I think, often confuses people. You were bought with a price, do not become slaves of men. And because Paul has been talking about slavery in the ordinary sense, it's assumed that he's still talking about that here, and it seems a bit surprising. He's been saying that it doesn't really matter either way, but then here he seems to be saying very strongly, don't become slaves. But I think he means a different kind of slavery now in verse 23. Here he's saying, don't become slaves of those in the church who are saying, well, as a Christian now, you need to be radical and rearrange everything in your life. Don't become slaves to them and their false teaching, which isn't biblical, which isn't coming from Christ. That is an infringement of your Christian liberty. You're at liberty to be this or that in terms of your life situation, to be here or there. You're at liberty in all these areas. Don't become slaves of those who are trying to restrict your liberty. You know, if we could only get this concept of our liberty when it comes to all these areas we're talking about, if we could only get this concept of our liberty as Christians, it would remove at a stroke that nonsense which entangles so many Christians regarding seeking and knowing God's will. So there's the possibility of going to this university or accepting that job, but you know, I need to be sure first. I need to be sure what God's will is and that I'm doing the right thing. There is no right thing in that situation. And there is no wrong thing in that situation either. God's will isn't that you choose a particular university or a particular job. That's your free choice. God's will is that you keep his commandments in whichever of those choices you opt for. That's God's will. If only we could grasp that, it would liberate so much of our tying ourselves up in knots. Oh, I don't know what God wants me to do. God, on the day of judgment, will not condemn anybody for taking the wrong job, living in the wrong place. It's keeping his commandments that matters, in whichever of those paths we choose to go down. And yes, some might be wiser than others, and we can perhaps sometimes make choices with motives that aren't particularly good, but the thing itself that we're choosing, none is right, none is wrong. God has given us freedom, liberty, and that is a liberating thing when we truly grasp that. So this mindset, it involves liberty. A second word, equality. Equality. Not only are all life situations lawful, but they are all equal in their value. They're all equal. Some aren't higher than others. So it's true then, isn't it, that marriage is a picture, human marriage is a picture of the ultimate marriage between Christ and his church. But that does not mean that you have more potential to serve and glorify Christ as a married person than you do as an unmarried person. It's true that singleness means that your attention is not consumed by another human being to whom you're joined, and Paul will talk about that in the next passage. But that doesn't mean that you have more potential to serve and glorify Christ as a single person than as a married person. All of these are equal. or think of jobs. And there aren't certain jobs then that are better and holier for others, holier than others for Christians to do. Because perhaps they have some point of contact with biblical truth. So, you know, a nurse is a particularly good job for a Christian because, Good Samaritan-like, you're then helping and serving others. Or a gardener is a good job for a Christian because Adam was made a gardener right at the outset. Or a scientist is a good job for a Christian because then you're tracing God's design in the universe. Paul debunks all of that in verse 22. You can be a Christian, he says there. You can be a Christian and thus, by definition, a liberated man or woman, set free by the blood of the cross, and yet you can be spending your days being ordered by an overbearing master to clean floors and empty toilets. And that paradox, Paul says, is absolutely fine. He who is called in the Lord as a slave is a freedman of the Lord anyway. Paul's fine with that paradox. This free person, liberated by the blood of the cross, and he's there wiping floors all day, being barked at by his overbearing master. That's fine, Paul says. I'm happy with that paradox. Just as you can be a Christian and thus by definition a slave under the lordship of Jesus Christ, and yet you can spend your days freely running your own home and your own business and all the rest of it. And again, Paul says that's just fine. Likewise, verse 22, he who was free when called is a slave of Christ. Paul is happy with these paradoxes. You see, there are better and holier ways of doing your job. But there aren't better and holier jobs. There are jobs, there may be some jobs that are intrinsically immoral, as I've already said. I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about jobs generally. There are better and holier ways of doing them, but there aren't better and holier jobs. Being a banker in the city, surrounded by greed every single day. Being a dancer on the stage in the West End. Being a grave digger making holes in the ground in which to bury the bearers of God's image. You can serve and glorify Christ in those jobs just as well as any other Christian in any other profession can. All life situations equal in their potential for glorifying Christ. Liberty, equality, and then one more word, preoccupation. Preoccupation. So I said earlier that the Christian can change his or her life situation. The Christian doesn't need to, but the Christian can. Paul clearly gives room for that in that parenthesis in verse 21. But I just want to close with a comment on that, because we live, don't we, in an extremely restless society. Previous generations here, and still people in many parts of the world, the scope for choice in life situations was in the past, and is, as I say, in other parts of the world, very limited. I mean, you used to just do the job that your parents did, and you lived probably in the same area that your parents lived in, and perhaps you even inherited the house that your parents had lived in. But now it's different, isn't it, in our society? Now the world's your oyster. Now the choices you can make for your life are endless. And that sounds very liberating, doesn't it? But in actual fact, I think it probably does create a huge amount of restlessness. We're always on the lookout for greener grass on the other side of the fence. And as Christians, I think we must beware that. Yes, we're free to make changes to our circumstances, but we mustn't become fantasists, preoccupied with finding greener grass. Now, our preoccupation must be those five words in verse 19, keeping the commandments of God. That must be our obsession. That must be our preoccupation. Keeping the commandments of God in whatever my life situation is right now. Yes, it may not always be my life situation, At some point, I may do a different job and live in a different place, but my great responsibility isn't to obsessively create some wished-for alternative set of circumstances which hopelessly distracts me from the present set of circumstances I'm in. No, my present responsibility, my great responsibility, is to get on keeping the commandments of God in these circumstances. We saw last time, my present circumstances are a gift from God. That's what Paul writes in verse 7 of this passage. And in verse 17, here at the start of our passage, as I mentioned in the prayer, he says that our present circumstances have been assigned by the Lord Jesus. We've no right to hold them at arm's length and look contemptuously at the circumstances that we happen to be in tonight. And so my overriding concern, my overriding preoccupation, shouldn't be where can I get some greener grass. It should be how do I keep the commandments of God in this plot line that for the time being my life is following. May God help us. Amen.